This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
African countries have been paying or not paying or paying a little for so long that, you know, the Minister of Finance is, you know, why should we now pay more than we have in the past?
That's Lise Louw-Vaudran, the International Crisis Group Senior Advisor for the African Union, about the growing strain on the AU's budget from peacekeeping missions. Details coming up. Also, a UN agency says the number of people displaced by fighting in Sudan has more than doubled in just a week. And over 400 people are dead and more than 4,300 missing in floods in the eastern DRC. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. So we start with our top story. VOA TV journalist and multimedia specialist Paul Indiho recently had a chance to travel to the city of Goma in the eastern DRC. He is now in studio to brief us on the trip. Welcome to African News Tonight, Paul.
It's great being here. Thank you so much.
So you first landed in Goma. Your impressions?
A remarkable town. Very beautiful. It's very clean compared to most cities that I've been to. But outside of Goma then lies the big picture, the big things that we talk about all the time.
That's where we're heading. For decades, the Democratic Republic of the Congo has been the scene of one of the largest, longest-running conflicts. The eastern DRC has been plagued by fighting by at least 122 rebel groups, according to a recent count by the United Nations, the ADF, CODECO, M23, to name a few. So, have these groups, Paul, pulled away from the area when you reached there, or has the Eastern African Regional Force taken over as a peacekeeper?
You see, there are a lot of dynamics at play in when it comes to the Congo. Yes, you have a lot of elements who are destabilizing the region. But to be specific, the M23 has done its fair share of the destruction of that part of Congo. So as we speak, the M23 is no longer, is still there, but it's not as visible as it should or as it was in the past. So they've scaled back their operations. They're out. They've been pushed out by the East African Regional Forces that now control some of those areas that were once held by M23 rebels.
When we talk about the East Africa Regional Forces, what countries does it compromise?
It's a combination of about seven countries, but as we speak, we have Kenyan troops, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. Tanzanian troops have been there, but they operate in a different region called Beni, so they're not within Goma.
So this mineral-rich eastern DRC, as reported, has been the battleground for more than 100 armed groups fighting for control of territory there or using it as a base to launch attacks into some of its immediate neighbors, Angola, Burundi, Central African Republic, Rwanda, and Uganda. So consequently, that has led to the death and displacement of many Congolese citizens. You visited this displacement camps. I would like you to share your observation on the IDPs.
I mean, the story of Congo is one of those tragic stories. You have so many things happening at the same time. At the top of the story, you talked about how there's this new wave, the floods that have killed nearly 400, over 5,000 displaced. But on the other hand, you have over a million people internally displaced persons in the DRC. They are all within about maybe 15 or 10 kilometers outside of the capital, the provincial capital of North Kivu, which is Goma. So as you drive around the city, as you drive outside of the city, it hits you. You realize that, oh man, there are so many people who have been displaced by this conflict, especially women and children. You have so many of them in the camps. Every camp that we visited at least 10 camps. Every camp that we visited, when you walk into those camps, there's no water, no food, no medicine. People are just there, basically hanging around, fending for themselves. The international community has disappeared. There is no funding. All these aid agencies are just there waiting to see if things can get better. But how can they get better? You constantly have these pressures that push the people to come into the camps. And obviously, nobody has had to control that kind of movement because the rebels are all over the place, destabilizing the place. So that's what pushes people into these camps.
It must have been a harrowing experience watching this kind of chaos without no international aid agency helping.
It's a very, very tragic scenario. When you talk to the women there, most of the women have been sexually violated. You look at the children, they are dealing with the same issues. There is no privacy, nothing. So basically, they are just left, the people are left to fend for themselves and just take care of themselves.
VOA TV journalist and multimedia specialist Paul Ndiho, thank you for your input. And for more of Paul Ndiho's coverage of the Eastern DRC, check out voaafrica.com. Communities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo are mourning after floods and mudslides killed at least 400 people and left more than 4,300 people missing in southern Kivu province. There's a disaster that hit the village of Bushushu and Nyamkubi. Came a few days after floods killed more than 130 in neighboring Rwanda and several people in Uganda. Thousands have been left homeless in the region. Reporter Zanem Neti Zaidi has more from Goma in the DRC.
In Nyamukubi, families are still searching for their loved ones in the rubble. But people who are still looking for theirs say they are not receiving any support. Pascal Buhendwa has been looking for his relatives for several days. He says, since while searching, he has already saved 30 injured people and found 15 bodies. He has been looking for his brothers for 3 days. He has not eaten and shows his stomach to indicate how hungry he is. He urges the Congolese government to intervene and provide survivors with assistance. Death has knocked on the door of many families, with he and others taking part in the search for bodies. Some go to the office of the village chief, where the corpses are peeled up. Aziza Lingoma came here in the hope of reuniting with her family. She has been severely disappointed. She says she lost her whole family, a total of 18 relatives here in Nyamukubi, and she is the only one left, the single survivor. She decided to come and see the bodies because she stayed behind yesterday for fear of fainting. The toll is heavy and is estimated at more than 400 dead. The disaster came on market day, which brings together several traders from different parts of the province. In Goma, residents observed the mourning that was decreed by the Congolese government. On Monday morning, a few shops and stores did not open their doors and traffic was paralyzed before resuming in the afternoon. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Nechizaidi in Nyamukubi in South Kivu province.
Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say the remains of at least 20 people have been found in a mass grave in an area used to cultivate cocoa in Ndomo village in the North Kivu province this weekend. A team of forensic and security officers exhumed the bodies after residents of the village in Beni territory found bones and clothing and alerted officials. The remains were discovered in an area that was under control of the Allied Democratic Forces, a rebel militia with links to the Islamic State group, and has been retaken by the Congolese army this year. There are growing concerns that the African Union won't have the funding necessary to intervene in multiple crises facing the continent in the near future. Analysts say the financial model on which the AU is based is failing. The AU itself recently said it isn't financed in a predictable, sustainable, equitable, or accountable manner. Darren Taylor reports.
The AU says 28 of 55 member states don't pay their yearly contributions to the institution tasked with upholding peace and stability and ensuring economic progress in Africa. At a meeting last year, the official in charge of the AU's finances, Dr. Monique Nsanzabaganwa, expressed hope that countries would use future economic benefits from the African Continental Free Trade Area wisely.
It also provides an avenue for member states to mobilize the requisite financial resources required to implement our various development programs in our quest for self-sufficiency and self-reliance.
But the International Crisis Group's senior advisor for the AU, Liesel Lowe-Vordran, says the organization remains very far from financial independence. She says it's overly dependent on funding from international donors to manage its programs and operations.
The African Union's total budget is around $600 million per year. And more than 60% of that is funded by international partners, mostly the European Union. On the African side, five countries pay the most, including South Africa, Nigeria, Morocco, Algeria, and Egypt.
She says not all the countries defaulting on payments to the AU are too poor to afford the levies, as they seem to have no problem paying the requisite fees to the United Nations.
African countries have been paying or not paying or paying a little for so long that, you know, the Minister of Finance says, you know, why should we now pay more than we have in the past? So for symbolic reasons, it's important to get to a point where the African Union pays the entire budget. It's not a lot of money when you see what is being spent on other things. And we have 55 member states. So
Lowe-Vordran says peacekeeping operations are currently costing the AU astronomical amounts of money, which further erodes the organization's capacity.
Some of these peacekeeping operations are something like $1 billion a year. Like in the DRC, there are 20,000 troops. You can imagine the cost of that. There are a plethora of peacekeeping operations. What often happens is the African Union steps in the Sahel, in Burundi, the DRC, South Sudan. African Union comes in the emergency, launches an operation, lots of African soldiers get killed, then the African Union just can't sustain it, and then it gets transformed into a UN peacekeeping mission.
Lowe-Vordran says this does nothing for the credibility of the AU and makes a mockery of its motto of African solutions for Africa's problems. She points out the AU's programs and operations are always in danger of collapse, especially given the current economic climate when big international donors are themselves cash-strapped. That's why, she says, it's so important for the AU to cultivate a more diverse range of funding as soon as possible, with the help of all member states. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. The International Organization for Migration reports the number of people forcibly displaced by fighting in Sudan has more than doubled in just 1 week. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Last Tuesday, the number of people who had been forcibly displaced by the fighting, which broke out on April 15th, stood at 340,000. Data collected by the UN Migration Agency, or IOM, showed that figure has more than doubled to over 700,000. This number is on top of the estimated 3.7 million people who had been forcibly displaced in the country prior to the fighting, which erupted between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces just over 3 weeks ago. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says people have been fleeing to multiple areas in search of safety. He says they have gone to places that already harbored many displaced, including the White Nile, River Nile, Northern State, Al Jazeera State, as well as the capital Khartoum, where clashes are ongoing.
Decisions that people are making to move are influenced by so many different factors, events on the battlefield and the extent to which conflict is encroaching upon their communities are one. But of course, it's very difficult right now to find money. The ATMs aren't working. The banking system is not functioning. Fuel is difficult to come by and expensive.
He says the cost of interstate transport reportedly is increasing dramatically. He says it is difficult to know how this will play out and where people are likely to go in the hopes of finding aid and protection from the violence.
Many IDPs are sheltering with relatives, while others are gathering in schools, mosques, and public buildings, scenes that we see repeatedly over and over again around the world. The IOM has stock of non-food items in 6 warehouses around the country, but to date we have been unable to deliver to those in need.
Dillon warns this doleful situation is likely to persist for as long as the prevailing conditions of insecurity persist. He says the fighting must end. He says the warring parties must make it possible for humanitarians to resume their life-saving work before this untenable situation spirals out of control. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Top officials from the United States and Saudi Arabia are involved in the push for a ceasefire in Sudan through a U.S.-Saudi initiative. However, some former U.S. diplomats doubt there will be a permanent ceasefire or an end soon to the war between Sudan's army and its paramilitary rapid support forces. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Shanawi has more.
So far, there are no reports of significant progress in the talks in Jeddah, which began Saturday despite the involvement of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. In a joint statement, the United States and Saudi Arabia urged both parties to consider the interests of the Sudanese nation and its people and actively engage in the talks toward a ceasefire and end to the conflict. Hundreds of civilians have died in more than 3 weeks of fighting, and hundreds of thousands have fled their homes, and the United Nations warns of a massive humanitarian crisis. Sudan's military ruler, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has said the talks with the paramilitary rapid support forces will have no benefit without a ceasefire. General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who leads the RSF, said the group appreciates all efforts to establish a ceasefire and provide the Sudanese people with aid. Ambassador Donald Booth, former U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan, spoke to VOA's Carol Castile on the program Encounter about possible approaches for mediation.
There's two ways you can go about this. You can try to get everybody beforehand to say, let's all get behind one proposed mediator and then kind of tell the Sudanese they have to work with that. Or we can say, here, everybody is out there offering mediation. Let the Sudanese decide who they will actually sit down with and then get behind that.
Ambassador Tibor Nagy, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, agrees with the concept. He notes, however, that Sudan is a crossroad between the Middle East and Africa, so neighboring countries have their own interests in Sudan. On VOA's Encounter program, Nagy said, while there are many forces at work, the international community has to be united with the same message to the two warring sides.
The world needs to show some unity. Who is going to engage with them? Who is going to send the message? It has to be the same message. And at the end of the day, no matter how many international initiatives there are, the two protagonists have to be willing to stop fighting.
Nagy does not expect a speedy end to the Sudanese conflict as long as the two generals have their hands on weapons and are getting tremendous pressure from their own constituencies based on their economic interests. But Ambassador Booth warns if the war continues, neighboring countries will be concerned that instability could spill over and create an entrenched ethnic-based civil war.
I think everybody's interest in stability is what we need to build on, and which I believe the United States is working on right now, which is trying to bring the various components together. And there, I think it's the Gulf states and Egypt, and the United States can really play that facilitative role. And I think what I've seen is we are trying to do that. And we put a lot of high-level attention into that, and I hope that will continue.
The fighting began when Al-Burhan and Dagalo disputed plans to create a transitional government leading to civilian rule. Some regional analysts say to end the conflict, the two generals should not be part of the solution and must exit the political scene. But the two U.S. diplomats say, for now, both generals have to be part of the solution until Sudan finds a leader able to gradually bring the country towards democracy, reducing the power of the military after decades of its involvement in politics and economy. For VOA, Mohammed Al-Shinawi, Washington.
The UN says more than 4 million people in Nigeria's northeast are facing severe food shortages as global aid is stretched thin. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs took journalists to the region to see the worsening situation. Timothy Obiezu files this report from Maiduguri in Nigeria's Borno state.
This bustling city does not reflect the terror that lurks on the fringes. Islamist militants at war with the government. But even here, young kids are reeling from the impact of devastating food shortages worsened by conflict. Days ago, Bintu Hassan's 2-year-old son arrived at this hospital ward, wasted and hypoglycemic. She says she's already suffered too much loss.
I gave birth to 4 children, but 2 died due to malnutrition. I have 2 left, and this one is also sick. I was referred to this place.
More than 700,000 kids in Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states suffer from severe acute malnutrition, according to the United Nations. The UN says the situation could get worse between June and September, the so-called hunger gap period when food stocks from the previous harvest traditionally run out. Last year's bumper harvest was disrupted by Nigeria's worst flooding in a decade. UN resident coordinator Mathias Shimali explains.
With 600,000 hectares of farmland destroyed, washed away, there will in the immediate future be serious food shortages.
And there isn't enough food aid to go around. This is Ran, a community near Nigeria's border with Cameroon. Residents say no aid has arrived here in 8 months. Kelu Modu says without much food, she couldn't breastfeed her baby and she became malnourished.
When I gave birth to this baby, there was not enough breast milk to feed the baby with, and the baby started vomiting and also had diarrhea.
The food shortage is in part a result of Russia's war in Ukraine and the recent crisis in Sudan. But officials say Nigeria's inflation and recent currency reform policy also constrained people's ability to buy food. UNICEF nutrition manager Karanveer Singh says despite crucial aid diverted to other global emergencies, Nigeria is still getting food supplies.
The global package for different, because of different emergencies in the world, is shrinking. But presently, we are well placed. But of course, we would need continued support.
Nigerian security forces have significantly degraded the fighting power of the militants. But the country is still at war. And until that is over, millions will be fighting a different type of war, hunger. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Maiduguri, Borno State, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.